well-tended houses. Pop stopped the truck in front of a big one and told me to get out. I helped him slide the Victrola crate onto the hand truck as best I could with one arm and a plaster of Paris cast, steadying it as Pop grunted his way up the porch steps. After he knocked, a little girl no taller than my belt pulled the curtain back from a side window and stared up at us. She was light brown and pigtailed with mischief in her eyes. Pop knocked again, and soon after that, an elegant woman in a pale green dress stood in the open doorway while the little girl hid behind her skirt. "It's so nice to see you, Mr. Tillman," the woman said. "Please forgive Esther. She isn't allowed to open the door for anyone she doesn't recognize." Pop tipped his cap in greeting and told the lady that was a wise rule indeed. She smiled, her straight white teeth standing out like pearls on jeweler's satin, and pointed us towards the parlor. Pop pushed the cart. I followed, thinking Mama would have liked how the gold flowers on the thick rug under my feet stood out against the blue background. Pop asked if we should unpack the crate and set the Victrola up, and the woman replied, "No, thank you," for her husband was looking forward to doing it himself when he got back from seeing patients. After which, Pop cleared his throat and said, "Then, that just left the matter of payment." "Of course," the woman murmured, and hurried off towards the back of the house, heels clicking against the polished wood floor. I looked around, taking in the room's fancy chandelier and furniture, trying to ignore Esther's gaze. She sat in a velvet-padded chair, feet swinging back and forth a good 6 inches over the rug. "I got no brothers, only sisters," she said. "You got a sister?" Pop stared overhead at a painting of fruit, pretending he hadn't heard. And the vision of my baby sister flashed through my mind, 3 years old, shrieking with glee as Pop tossed her into the air. "Again!" she'd cried as Mama feigned disapproval and Pop launched her higher and higher, until he finally caught her up for good and covered her flushed cheeks with kisses. "My sister's an angel in heaven," I told Esther in a tight-jawed voice, thinking how sometimes good memories hurt worse than bad. Esther thought on that a while, then looked at me square and said, "That's sad. You want one of mine?" Little as I cared to engage in further conversation with her, I couldn't help replying, "One of your sisters?" And she eyed me like maybe I was slow in the head and said, "Sure, I got two of them. Take your pick." I laughed in spite of myself. "You can't give away your sisters," I said. "They're family." Which turned Esther's face angry and set her feet to kicking harder right up until she heard her mother's footsteps coming back. Pop turned away from the painted bowl of fruit, smiling his best salesman smile. And when she arrived, he counted out the bills she handed him, one by one. There should have been $315 in all, plus $5 for delivery. The VE-300 was a pricey model. Not the most expensive, far from the cheapest. But when Pop was done, he handed $2 back, saying, "It's $320 even, Mrs. Butler." That flustered the lady badly. "Yes," she stammered, "but I thought, for your time..." "Delivery's $5, Pop said. "No tipping necessary." Then Mrs. Butler did her best to compose herself as Pop thanked her for her business and wheeled the hand cart across the fancy carpet and out the front door. He never spoke a word the whole way home, but after he'd parked the truck behind the Model T under the porte cochere, he said, "A sale's a sale, William. Things are hard now, what with crude oil prices so low. If a Negro comes to me with money in his pocket, I'll hold my nose and sell him a Victrola. Jim Crow be damned. As for tonight, we had a late customer. That's what you tell anyone who asks, your mama included. Do as I say, and I'll teach you to drive this truck once your wrist's healed." Then he tugged down the brim of his hat and got out. And though that certainly wasn't the last delivery we ever made to Greenwood, it was the last time the matter was ever discussed. I never hid from Addie. Not exactly. But Central High had enough students so that as long as you didn't share classes with the person, you could pretty well stay away from them. You couldn't avoid crossing paths completely, though, especially if they had a mind to hunt you down. And at lunchtime, the day after my first trip to Greenwood, Addie did. She found me in the cafeteria holding a cheese sandwich in my good hand and explaining yet again how my wrist got broke. Cleet sat at my side, for though things had cooled between us after the two-knock, habit kept us from separating completely at school. We'd even settled into a kind of routine, where I'd tell how I'd saved an unnamed but ever-so-lovely young lady from the savage advances of a Negro cad, and Cleet would nod and utter exclamations of agreement every now and again. With each retelling, Clarence Banks grew an inch, gained 10 pounds, and turned 2 shades darker. On top of that, my pitiful punch turned into something fierce, and a baseball bat assumed responsibility for breaking my wrist rather than my own drunken stumbling. Out of all the lies I'd worked up, my favorite was the one I used to finish the story. "He tried to bash my head in, boys. My poor arm here was all that stood between me and certain death." How'd he put an end to all that? She came at me sideways, inching up so quiet that I didn't see her until a flash of blue gingham caught the corner of my eye. Fast as lightning, she slapped me hard enough that the sound of it silenced all the lunchtime chatter around us. I can still feel the sting today, and hear her thick words in my ear. "He might die. Did you know that? They beat him so bad he might die." My hand went to my cheek. Addie's fury had coiled her up and washed her out, save for her red-rimmed eyes and 2 angry spots of color on her cheeks. "Being a dunce," I replied, "who?" The wrath in Addie's eyes rendered down to fat, shiny tears. "Clarence. Clarence might die. And all because of a stupid little boy with a stupid little crush and too much chalk in his belly. You can go to hell for all I care, Will Tillman, if hell will have you." Far as those harsh, hushed words knocked me back, they didn't prevent me from seeing our mathematics teacher, Ms. Newland, eyeing us from across the room. I dragged my hand from my cheek, and the red mark Addie slapped surely must have left there. Ms. Newland made her way towards us, and the next thing I knew, Addie was clearing her throat, telling her everything was fine. The teacher surveyed us with her little piggy eyes and asked about the noise she'd just heard. I held my chin sideways, angling my struck cheek away. One of the boys beside me, a wax-skinned trumpet player named Bert, held up a library book and said, "I dropped this, ma'am. Sorry about the ruckus." Ms. Newland looked both unconvinced and too tired to care. Word around school was that her preacher husband had run off to St. Louis with the church secretary 2 months prior, leaving the woman more dour than ever. Distracted, too. She glanced up at the big clock over the doorway, smoothed her skirt, and shooed us off to class. We yes-ed her and gathered our things while she walked away. That's when Addie put herself in front of me. So close I could have kissed her. "They whipped him yesterday," she whispered, "and beat him and left him in the street to die. Far as I'm concerned, you're as much to blame as they are. And if he does die, that's murder. Just you remember that, Will Tillman, murder."
Rowan. Police detectives are a lot less interesting in real life than on TV. The ones who showed up at our house weren't quirky, they didn't drop smart-ass one-liners, and their khakis and polo shirts made them look an awful lot like accountants with guns. After spending maybe 5 minutes alone in the back house, they came out and told us someone from the medical examiner's office was coming to assess the scene. Then Dad raised the umbrella on the table at the pool, and the 6 of us, Mom, Dad, James, the detectives, and I sat around it. The detectives asked easy questions. What time did the construction crew show up? How long did they stay? When did I see the body for the first time? Stuff like that. They didn't even seem upset that James and I had opened the tarp and touched the gun and the brick and the actual body. I mean, I knew it was a cold case, but the way they acted, the skeleton might as well have been a forgotten ice cube at the back of the freezer. Really? The only time things got a little tense was when the woman detective asked Mom for the contractor's contact info. Mom recited it from memory, but said that since the body looked as if it had been there a long time, and since the construction workers had taken off right after they found it, she hoped there wouldn't be any need to track them down. The detectives traded a look. They understood perfectly well that Mom was asking them to leave the workmen alone. Then the man said they had to investigate every potential homicide thoroughly. He seemed nervous about it, though, watching Dad to see his reaction. And Dad cleared his throat and said basically the same thing Mom had, but in his, "I know a lot of important people" voice. The detectives looked at each other again, only longer, and the man cleared his throat and repeated his line about being thorough, adding, "Of course, we aren't really interested in pursuing unrelated legal infractions, Mr. Chase. I can assure you of that." Which, roughly translated, meant that since Dad, the guy whose family name was on a building downtown, had asked them to lay off, they would. Funny how that worked. The rest of their questions went quickly. Mom kept her word and made sure James left for work on time. A stubby man from the medical examiner's office showed up around 11, smelling like Sonic onion rings and wearing what I sincerely hoped was a ketchup stain on his shirt. He snapped a few pictures, filled out some forms, and announced it was a case for the forensic anthropologist. "I'll call Jenny Roop," he said. "This is right up her alley." After the ME guy left, Dad told the detectives he'd appreciate it if they'd keep things low-key and out of the local news. "They made us promise not to mess with the skeleton. We promised we wouldn't, and that was pretty much the end of things." So my very first interrogation by the police was basically a snooze fest. Or at least it would have been if James and I hadn't lied our faces off about whether or not we'd taken anything from the body. "Oh, no, sir," I'd said when the detective asked, thinking all the while about the rectangle of leather I'd stolen from the skeleton's pocket, and how glad I was that it wouldn't end up forgotten at the bottom of a police evidence box. "We put the gun and the brick back, right where we found them." The thing was a wallet, cracked and covered in mildew, with rotted out stitching on one side of its change pocket. I'd figured out that particular little detail earlier when I'd run upstairs to get dressed, paused just long enough to see what my contraband actually was, and tossed it under my bed. Even before the wallet landed, loose coins clinked and rolled across the hardwood floor, giving me one of those "oh shit" moments, worrying Mom would hear the noise from the kitchen underneath me and use her powers of maternal omniscience to figure out I was up to something. Lucky for me, either she didn't hear or she tapped out her powers for the day, catching James and me with the skeleton. Still, I waited until after the detectives were gone and Mom and Dad had left for work to gather up the coins. Honestly, being bad felt kind of good. James and I could be obnoxious when we wanted to, but underneath our snarky outer shells, we were basically rule followers. Good kids. Nerds. Enough so that guilt kept me from looking at the wallet closely. Until I got to Utica Square, at least. Utica's a shopping center. High-end, close to our house. Where the flower beds are perfect and the luxury cars roam free. James made fun of me for liking it there, but he was at work, and I only had 18 hours left before my summer of forced laboratory servitude started. I deserved a little treat. The azaleas were in manic bloom in Woodward Park. I slowed down, watching a photographer snap pictures of a couple on the rocks above the pond. Everyone does their engagement shots at Woodward. It's practically a city ordinance. Just past that, at the emergency room entrance to St. John's, the usual cluster of worn-out hospital workers hunched over their cigarettes, sucking in tar and nicotine. I rolled up my window against the smoke, turned into Utica Square at the next light, and found a shaded parking space underneath a magnolia. I snagged a spicy tuna roll at the grocery store where gray-haired ladies can still get their groceries carried out by bag boys, walked over to Starbucks, and sat down with an iced coffee at one of the shaded tables outside. It was a good day to watch people. Tiny blonde ex-sorority queens with perfect makeup, doctors in scrubs getting their afternoon caffeine, kids zoning out on iPads while their moms texted and sipped skinny iced lattes. Everyone was always so comfortable with themselves there. So confident. Across the courtyard, two little girls chased each other around the fountain I fell into when I was three. Mom had taken me to sit on Santa's lap in the warm little cottage they set up there every year, then walked me down to the fountain to make a wish. I remember eating the cookie Mrs. Claus had given me, and Mom digging around in her purse for pennies. Then the purse was on the ground, and business cards and stray sheets of folded paper danced away like one-winged butterflies on the chilly Oklahoma wind. "Stay put," Mom said, dashing after them. And I had, until the wind pushed a silver tube of her lipstick toward the flat edge of the fountain. I loved that lipstick, because Mom had gotten my lips with it once as I watched her get ready to go out. "Rub them together like this," she'd said, showing me how. I'd done the exaggerated little kid version, smearing deep red pigment all over my face. She told me I looked beautiful anyway. It made me feel special. There was no way I was going to let that tube roll into the fountain. And I caught it, too, right before I tripped and went into the water head first. Mom caught the back of my sweatshirt, yanked me out, and rushed me to the car to get warm. My teeth chattered, and my fingers went numb, but I could feel the thrum of her heartbeat and the panicked strength of her arms. That was the first time I'd ever seen my mother scared, and the memory of it has stuck with me in high-res living color ever since. I laid $2.61 in coins from the wallet out on the table. They were tarnished and stamped with dates ranging from 1916 to 1921. Other than that, the wallet was empty. It wasn't much to go on, but at least I knew the skeleton's owner had been alive in 1921. Maybe a few years after that, too, but 21 was a good baseline. I sipped my coffee, two pumps of sweetener, room for cream, and caught the hipster at the next table staring at me over his laptop. My phone vibrated against the metal table. "Brady tonight?" Hipster dude smiled through his beard. I smiled, just a little, and texted James back. "Okay, but early. Work tomorrow." I swept the coins into my hand, picked up my sushi, and crossed the courtyard to my car. Hipster dude gave me a curled finger wave as I drove past. I waved back, knowing that even though James wasn't into romance, I'd take hanging out with my best friend over flirting with a bearded lumberjack wannabe any day, and twice on Sunday.
William. Vernon Fish had scared me from the day he parked a 6-foot-tall wooden cigar store Indian outside his shop and stalked across the street to say hello. I happened to be dropping Pop's lunch off at the time, and I'll never forget the smell of hair tonic and fried onions that followed Vernon in. It had turned our familiar shop, with its scraped pine floors and fleur-de-lis stamped tin ceiling, into some place cold and foreign. Even the cozy glow from the Chinese lanterns Mama had hung over the ceiling bulbs couldn't warm the place up when Vernon visited. I'd feared him from the moment we met, and he knew it. So it was a bother and a misfortune that not 3 hours after Addie slapped me in the lunchroom, a storm front blew dark skies and cold rain into town, and Vernon Fish into our shop. For, miserable as it was outside, Victrolas and smokes were the last things on the minds of the few waterlogged souls sloshing their way along Main Street. "Go stand by that window, half-breed," Vernon said, barely glancing my way as he talked through the doors, "and tell me if I get any customers." I came out from behind the mahogany Victrola cabinet I'd been polishing and did as I'd been told. Vernon may have been only a few years older than me, but he was not a man to be trifled with. Then Vernon went to the wooden counter that spanned nearly the whole length of the back wall and leaned his meaty forearms onto it, puffing on one of the foul Maduro Robustos he favored. Between the stink of that cigar and the way Addie's words still sawed at my gut, I was halfway to losing what little lunch I'd eaten. "Stanley," he said in his deep Georgia drawl, "I come over to let you know I met up with some of the Ku Klux Klan's most influential leaders last night, and seeing how you took a squaw for a wife, you ended up being the topic of some discussion." Pop's face betrayed no emotion as he rolled an unlit Corona between his fingers. He never actually smoked them, just chewed one end and sniffed the tobacco leaves. Bad as they smelled when they burned, sometimes I wish he'd just up and light one. Vernon tapped ash from his Maduro into the ashtray that Pop kept for customers, and drew another mouthful of smoke before he continued. See, the Klan may not have much of a presence here yet, but they've got big plans for Tulsa. Big enough that we decided we need upstanding business owners such as yourself too much to begrudge you your, shall we say, exotic choice of spouse. Pop replied with a false smile. Though he didn't say so, he knew perfectly well that Mama's Osage roots ran deeper into the soil under our feet than his or Vernon's either one, making her about as exotic as an Oklahoma redbud tree. Why, not 30 years prior, the land Tulsa sat on had belonged to Indians, Muscogee Creek, Cherokee, and Osage. The Perryman family alone had near single-handedly founded the place, and they were mostly Muscogee Creek. And the better part of Oklahoma itself had been called Indian Territory right up until it became a state in 1907. Far as I could tell, Indians and part Indians like me had just as much right to be there as anyone. More, even. Now, Vernon, Pop said, that willingness wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that my wife is a wealthy woman, would it? Vernon looked offended. Quite the contrary, he said. In fact, we want to give you money. Once you join the Klan, you'll earn a commission for every new member you recruit. Like the one you'll get if I join? Pop asked. Vernon shook his head and looked all sad and hangdog, like Pop had wounded his soul. That's not why I want you in, Stanley, and you know it, he said. Supporting the Klan's the right thing to do. We got colors around these parts thinking they're good as white folks. Black Wall Street, my foot. That strip of junk shops and cat houses up on Greenwood ain't nothing but a blighted piece of Africa befouling our fair city. A hint of a smile flickered across Pop's face. I'm not sure Vernon saw it, but I did. And Pop said how he'd heard tell that the Negro Quarter up around Greenwood was one of the richest of its kind in the whole country. Plus, they had folks like that Dr. Jackson, who trained at the Mayo Clinic and treated white and Negro women both. And what about John and Lula Williams with their Dreamland Theater and confectionery and garage that fixed as many white folks' cars as coloreds? Vernon turned his head sideways and spit a piece of tobacco off the tip of his tongue, said, Seems to me that when white men such as yourself start talking like that, Stanley, it's a sure sign folks up in Little Africa are due to be put back in their place. Besides, the Klan ain't just about keeping uppity Negroes in line, it's about making sure our town stays pure and righteous. There's white men abusing God's laws, too, and the Klan makes sure they get what they got coming. Especially all them Catholics and Jews moving in amongst us good Protestants, twisting the Bible around with their talk of blood and temples and such. Pop shrugged and said people's pocketbooks interested him more than their prayers. Vernon puffed a few times, then said how Pop should be grateful the Klan was willing to forgive him his Indian wife and let him join. Pop went tight-lipped and quiet. Vernon had finally got under his skin. What about you, half-breed? Vernon said, turning to me. How do you opine? I told him I didn't. And he said that was hogwash for a boy my age ought to have the world figured out and caught it by the tail. So I looked to Pop for help, and when none was forthcoming, I turned towards the window instead, pretending to watch Vernon's shop and muttering, I haven't got time for all that, Mr. Fish, what with school and work and all. And Vernon pounced, saying, Then it seems to me you oughtn't to have time to be out carousing at night getting in fights. And he weighted his words down heavy, letting me know there was more behind them than just bluster. The shop went quiet as the rain picked up outside, and the sky spit hail pebbles against the window. Vernon's lips made wet little pops, loosened smoke rings over the dark, slicked-back curls atop his head. After a while, I couldn't help but meet his eyes. And what I saw and the milky blueness of them sent a jolt through me like biting down on a bad tooth. He knew about the Tunnock. Vernon Fish knew.
Rowan. Finding a skeleton with a bashed-in skull was a bad way to start the day. Getting into a fight with my best friend was a supremely shitty way to end it. At first, things were fine. It was one of those gorgeous Oklahoma nights in the Brady Arts District when the sun hovers low in the sky so long you wonder if it's ever going to set. Even with the Drillers game at One Oak Field, James and I found parking spots outside the instrument repair shop that has rows of old violins hanging in the window. He wanted to catch a few innings from the $5 outfield lawn seats, but it gets crowded back there, and I wasn't crazy about the idea of people listening to our conversation. So we sat on one of the benches around the Guthrie Green splash pad instead, close enough to catch spray from the kids running through in their shorts and t-shirts, but far enough away from their parents to have some privacy. James and I go to the Brady a lot. It's a few blocks north of downtown and just west of Greenwood, with art galleries and restaurants and bars and a glass-blowing studio where they let you get close enough to the ovens to break a sweat. There's usually some kind of performance happening on the stage at the Green, red dirt bands, dancers, the symphony. That night it was actors in black leggings and white t-shirts doing scenes from Othello. A few families were scattered around on blankets, along with oldsters in lawn chairs, and a white couple with matching dreads making out next to their bikes. "What happened after I left?" James asked. "Anything good?" I pretended to think hard. "Oh, definitely. Let's see. You were there for most of our conversation with the world's least exciting police detectives. So the main thing you missed would have to be the medical examiner who spent 10 minutes not touching the body. And, oh yeah, you didn't get to hear Dad making sure our shiny family name stays out of the news." James's forehead wrinkled. "I promise," I said, "it was completely undramatic. Even this was a letdown." I took the wallet from my purse and handed it to him, busted side up. "See for yourself." He opened it up and felt around inside the empty bill compartment. "Careful," I said. "One side of the change pocket is shot." He caught 2 coins as they fell out. "We should have given this to the police. If they find out we took it," I cut him off. "Trust me, they won't. The detectives basically told Mom and Dad they're too busy with new cases to spend time on something this old. If the forensic anthropologist doesn't find anything, my guess is no one will. I'm glad we kept the wallet. At least this way, the two of us can do some detective work on our own." James jiggled the rest of the coins in his palm and turned them over one by one. "The newest's from 1921, he said. "Right. So unless someone snuck back to the crime scene, tore up the floor, and stuck fresh coins in the skeleton's wallet, it must have been a live human being then." A little girl next to us gathered water in her cupped hands and threw it in a littler boy's face. The boy ran off howling. James took out his phone, punched something in, and scrolled down muttering. "Well, that makes things interesting." I leaned closer. "What?" "The race riot was in 1921. Which, I confess, was something I didn't know much about beyond what we'd covered in 9th grade Oklahoma history. Something had happened between a black teenage boy and a white teenage girl in a department store elevator. Then things melted down outside the courthouse the next night. Most of Greenwood ended up burning, and everyone pretty much tried to forget about it. One thing I did remember was that no one knew for sure how many black people had been killed. But what stuck with me most was our teacher's description of how black survivors had been marched like prisoners of war to holding centers and forced to stay there until a white person showed up to vouch for them. Once they were released, they'd had to pin a green card onto their clothes that basically said, "I'm a good Negro." It wasn't exactly the same as the yellow stars the Nazis made Jewish people wear, but it wasn't completely different either. Still, I didn't see how the skeleton could have had anything to do with all of that. The riot happened at the northern edge of downtown and in Greenwood, not in my neighborhood. And even more than now, Maple Ridge in the 1920s had been for rich, white people. James kept messing with his phone, twisting his mouth up on one side. "There's a cold case database on the police department's website," he said. "But it only goes back to the 1970s. His fingers kept moving. "Jesus! Did you know 41 people were hanged in Oklahoma between 1907 and 1930? Most of them were black. And there were probably a lot more lynchings that never got recorded." I hadn't known that, and kind of wished I still didn't. James elbowed my ribs. "Did you hear me?" I elbowed him back. "I did, and it's awful. I'm just glad things are better now." A look came over James's face, like all of a sudden he couldn't recognize me. "Are they?" he said. I swung one leg behind the bench, straddling it so we were looking at each other. "Are they what?" "Better." I leaned away without meaning to. "I'm not an idiot, James. I know things aren't perfect now, but they aren't as bad as they were in the 1920s. People don't get lynched anymore. You and I can go anywhere we want. We're black, and we both go to a nicer school than most white kids." The wrinkles on his forehead disappeared and his face went blank. "It's way more complicated than that, Chase." I bit my tongue. "I never told you what happened to the guy I'm tutoring at the library, did I?" he said.
"No."
"Well, his name's Eduardo, and last month he spent 2 weeks hanging drywall for this contractor who promised him $1,500 cash for the work. Eduardo's got 3 kids. He's a good guy, and he wouldn't do things under the table if he could get a work permit. Only he can't. So he takes this job, and when he finishes and goes to the contractor to get paid, the contractor tells him, sure, he'll write a check, as soon as Eduardo shows him his papers. Only he knows Eduardo doesn't have papers. And since Eduardo can't go to the police and report him, he also knows there's no way he'll get caught. He ripped off my friend, and there's nothing Eduardo can do about it." "That sucks," I said. "And now I get why you were worried about the workmen. But Mom and Dad wouldn't hire a contractor like that. I'm sure the one they're using pays his workers." James was getting worked up. "That doesn't change the fact that the system's jacked against people like Eduardo and me." He said it loud enough to make the little girl in the splash pad look over at us. I tilted my head toward her, letting James know he needed to calm down, and whispered through my teeth, "There's a big difference between a mob lynching a black man and some asshole ripping off a guy because he's undocumented and you know it." James shook his head slowly. "The crime's different, but the problem's the same. It's about power and prejudice and shit rooted so deep that people don't see it anymore. You know we're 6 times as likely to go to jail as white people, right?" "Of course I know that," I shot back. "My mother's a black public defender, for God's sake, so you can skip the lecture." "You can't wish it away," James said softly. "Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Harris, Laquan McDonald, they're just the ones who made the news. And I know you know that. But sometimes you disappear inside this rich girl bubble where someone always fixes things when they go wrong, and your brown skin only counts against you until you mention your daddy's name. Most of us don't have that luxury, Chase. There's no room for us in your bubble." Things were happening inside me. Ugly, uncomfortable things that I can't even describe. But I wasn't going to let James see me cry. "I'm sorry I'm such a disappointment to you," I said around the tightness in my throat. James pretended to watch the actors on the stage. I got up, turned my back on my friend, and walked away. And I didn't shed a single tear. Not until I was safe inside my car, with the tinted windows rolled up and the door locked tight behind me.
William. It was torture, staring out into the rain on Main Street while Vernon Fish savored the effect of his words. He knew about me and Clarence Banks and clearly suspected I hadn't given Pop a full and accurate account of the circumstances behind my broken wrist. Now that he'd stuck the knife in me good, Vernon intended to enjoy twisting it. After a while, though, the silence got to be too much even for him, and he set about unraveling the rest of his smug tale. "See, I have this policeman friend, Carl," he said. "Works in a, well, I guess you'd call it an unsavory part of town. And Carl, he tells me there's establishments out there where Negroes and whites mix, drinking and dancing and sinning together in some kind of unholy mess. Turns my stomach just to think of it." This was news to neither Pop nor me. Everyone in town, even polite society ladies in their fancy hats and starched white dresses, knew about Tulsa's speakeasies and roadhouses. They also knew better than to talk about them. But Vernon jawed on, saying, "Yep, old Carl and me met up yesterday, and he told me about a little scene he come upon in one of these places the other night. Seems a white boy tangled with a big coon named Clarence something or other. Pissed old Clarence off so bad he broke that white boy's leg. Or was it his arm?" Vernon stopped, letting the weight of his words settle in on me and Pop. And there was nothing to fill the silence except for the sound of the rain. Not until Pop cleared his throat and said how he thought we might have a leak in the storeroom ceiling. And did Vernon have a bucket he could lend us to catch the drips? And Vernon, he just smirked and said, "Only bucket I got's underneath a drip of my own. I ain't through with my story neither. See, it turns out, old Clarence was such a coward that when he seen what he'd done to that poor white boy, he ran away with his tail between his legs. Only the cops found out his name, and just last night they caught him sitting down to supper with his little old mammy." At that, my heart set to beating fast. Mostly, I'll admit, because I feared further repercussions from Pop. But I like to think that some small part of me felt a twinge of guilt over the notion that Clarence Banks had suffered a beating on my account. And Vernon kept hammering away, saying, "Cops got ways of keeping the courthouse from getting too clogged up, see, and sometimes good citizens like me help 'em. We got solutions of our own for problems like old Clarence. Ones that don't cost more than a strop of leather and a length of sturdy rope." Pop wiped imaginary dust from the big, gilded cash register Mama had bought for him the year prior. Vernon blew three smoke rings, plop, 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 said, "Remind me to show you my whipping strap sometime, half-breed. 3 foot long it is, 4 inches wide. Got slits carved into the end. Make it cut through skin easier than warm butter." I tried not to let my fear show, but Vernon saw. He saw, and from the way his close-set eyes danced about, he liked it. "You understand, don't you, Will?" he said, "that righteous men take care of their own." I wasn't so sure that Vernon was qualified to give lectures on righteousness, but it seemed neither the time nor place to point that out. "Yes, Mr. Fish," I said. "And you want to overcome your own mongrel blood and be a righteous man, don't you?" To which I whispered, "Yes, once more." But that wasn't good enough for Vernon, who pounded his fist against the counter saying, "God gave you a voice, son. Use it, I tell you. Use it." I looked at Pop, wishing he'd say something, anything, to help me. But he just kept wiping non-existent dust off the register. So in the strongest voice I could muster, I looked Vernon Fish dead on and said, "Yes, Mr. Fish. Yes, I do." Whatever thoughts Pop may have had about Vernon Fish's tale, he kept them to himself. We were learning things about each other, Pop and me, and both of us had the good sense not to make a fuss over them. As for myself, I was a 17-year-old boy with all the wisdom and moral rectitude of a turnip. Bad as Vernon Fish had scared me, bad as I started feeling about Clarence Banks, It didn't take long to convince myself that Clarence would recover and the whole mess would go away if only I apologized to Addie. 2 days later, I waited for her outside school after dismissal to do just that. She must have seen me from the foyer, for she made a beeline down the front stairs and across the street, cutting westward in front of an oncoming sedan. "Addie!" I cried, thinking to stop her before she got killed. But she only sped up, forcing me into a jog. "Addie!" I hollered. "Addie, I'm sorry. Please, just wait a minute." Her footsteps slowed enough for me to catch up and fall in at her side. She wouldn't look at me, though, and I could feel her chilly disdain in spite of the warm afternoon sun. We walked side by side a good ways, me catching my breath, her refusing to acknowledge I was there. "I truly am sorry, Addie," I said, once I'd worked up the courage to speak. She glanced at me, barely, said, "What exactly is it you're sorry for, Will?" "Why, that you're upset, of course," I replied. Addie stopped and spun towards me, and it's a testament to my ignorance that I took her doing so as encouragement. "What about Clarence?" she asked. And though my main concern at that moment was to set things right with the girl I loved, I piped right up. "Oh, sure, him too." Addie's eyes narrowed, but I blathered on, saying it was a shame he'd touched her hand like that and how I wished he'd known better and hoped there wouldn't be any permanent damage from the beating he took. "Everyone deserves second chances," I added magnanimously. "Even Negroes." Then I stopped, waiting for the warm flood of forgiveness I considered my due. Only, when I looked closer to see what was holding Addie up, I finally registered the fullness of the disgust in her eyes and understood that my true love thought me no better than a pile of dog shit on the sidewalk. Then Addie walked away. Now, I wish I could say her reaction didn't surprise me or that the suffering I'd caused an innocent man weighed heavier on my conscience than it did, but that would be giving myself too much credit. The truth of the matter was, I came away from the whole incident believing myself to be the injured party. For shouldn't my apology have sufficed? And shouldn't any Negro man with half a brain know that no good could come of messing with a white woman in public? What's more, I told myself that Vernon and Addie must both have been exaggerating the extent of Clarence Banks's injuries. Why, he'd probably been no closer to death after his beating than before. Vernon Fish was a braggart, after all, and Addie a hysterical girl. With that fool line of reasoning in my head, I spent near a week feeling sorry for myself, licking my imagined wounds and scratching at the dry skin under my cast with a pencil. My path never once crossed Addie's, making it all the easier to maintain the delusion that I'd been in the right. And after those days of sulking and skulking about had passed, the delusion felt real enough that I let the matter go and moved on like the jackass I was. It helped that working in the shop suited me. I wasn't a natural-born salesman like Pop, but I loved music. Knew all about it, too, so that when people came in able to recall a line from a song they'd heard but not the title, Pop would say, "Let's see if William here can't divine what you're looking for." And he'd ask them to hum a few bars or sing the words, and most times I'd be able to name the tune straight away. Swanee, Crazy Blues, When My Baby Smiles at Me, I knew them all. Even when I couldn't figure out the exact song the customer wanted, I could almost always come up with something close enough to tempt them into buying a record or two. But when it came to selling Victrolas, Pop was the man for the job. He prided himself on knowing those machines inside and out, on being able to talk a person up from only thinking about maybe buying a cheap model to knowing they couldn't live without a fancy one. If he was busy with one customer and another came in, he'd have me entertain the newcomer with records until he could talk to them himself. In terms of brass tack Victrola sales, I kept my mouth shut. That went double when colored folks from Greenwood called up asking if we carried such and such a model they'd seen in a magazine or a catalog. "Telephone sales are tough," Pop told me. "You can't tempt folks with fancy cabinets and woodwork. So convincing them to spend more than they plan gets tricky. It's an art, describing different models for a telephone customer well enough that they end up feeling bad for wanting something simple when they could have something fine. Occasionally, though, even Pop failed to close a deal over the telephone. When that happened, he'd have no choice but to invite Negro customers into the shop after hours to look at the different models for themselves. He never did act ashamed of what he was doing, but he sure wasn't in a hurry to let nearby shop owners in on his secret, or to stand accused of spitting in Jim Crow's eye either. I always liked the hushed excitement of those visits. We'd hang the clothes sign out front, pull the shades down over the windows, and let our customer in through the alleyway door. The first time it happened, Pop told me, "You have to pretend the back is as good as the front. We know it isn't, and so do they. There's no need to belabor the point." In general, those late-night patrons were people Pop considered to be pillars of Tulsa's Negro society. Doctors, lawyers, merchants like himself. But when push came to shove, he wasn't about to lose a sale just because someone fell a rung or two short of respectable. And it was that drive in him, that will to make his business succeed, that led to my father being bested by an 18-year-old Negro boy, armed with nothing more than $100 and a frown grave enough to shame an undertaker.
Rowan. I always train hard, but the morning after my fight with James, my run wasn't really training so much as self-punishment. I was mad at myself, mad at him, and more than a little scared that maybe he'd been right. There's always been a love-hate thing between me and running. First off, if you don't get it over with at the ass crack of dawn, the Oklahoma summer sun will melt you into a puddle of good intentions. Plus, it hurts. I mean, have you ever seen a happy jogger? We scowl. We pant and grimace. In fact, if you ever see one of us smiling, you should assume we're a complete psychopath and run for your life. On the other hand, running's the best way I know to clear my head and get closer to fine. Which is why I was already 2 miles into an 8-mile run by 6:30 a.m., with the Arkansas River on my right and early Riverside Drive commuters speeding by on my left. The temperature hadn't dropped much during the night, and the humidity made me feel like I was sucking air through a wet sponge. It was perfect. At the start of mile 3, I ditched my warm-up playlist, cued hardcore training songs, and started the fartlek run my cross-country coach had posted the night before. Yes, fartlek is a ridiculous word, but it's basically just a fancy Swedish way of saying, play with your speed, which I did, using landmarks along the river to separate each segment. The first interval was a hard sprint. I switched to a jog at a downed tree limb, went to a fast jog at a flock of Canada geese, cranked into a sprint again at the haunted stone mansion across Riverside, kept it going until I thought I'd die. The sculpture of the bobcat catching a pheasant mid-flight was my turnaround point. It was also where I tried distracting myself from James by thinking about how I was about to spend the rest of my summer with safety goggles, micropipettes, and the scientists who loved them. All things considered, working in a virology lab was better than answering phones and entering data at Chase Oil. And it beat the hell out of doing legal research for Mom while she entertained me with her all-time favorite hits, including having a trust fund doesn't make you a success. And what about your college essay? You know you should really start your college essay. And Black women have to work twice as long and 5 times as hard to succeed in this world, so get used to it. All 3 of which were completely unnecessary, since I'd learned early on that the best way to keep her from putting too much pressure on me was to do it myself. Then I got sick of thinking altogether and decided to fly, legs pounding, arms pumping in a dead sprint, until my muscles and lungs screamed for mercy, and there was only a 1/4 mile between me and home. That was the best part of the whole ordeal, the part where I was too exhausted to think about anything except a cold shower, obscene amounts of orange juice, and the post-run buzz I'd have for the next hour or so. For that short, precious quarter mile, I floated along the bike path while the city woke up around me. I didn't worry about the skeleton in the back house. I didn't stress over my sucky summer internship. And I reminded myself that no matter how mad James and I got at each other, we always worked things out. Dark corners and all, we were in it for the long haul. "Which doctor?" the receptionist at the front desk asked, again. I told her Dr. Kumar, again, and that my mother had arranged for me to intern with her that summer. The receptionist stared at her computer screen like it was the magic eight ball. "I just started here 2 days ago, and I don't know any Dr. Kumar. Was it maybe Dr. Kim? We've got one of those." By that point, I'd already pulled up my Dr. Kumar folder to show her the forwarded emails from Mom, the three letters of recommendation I'd gotten from teachers, and the waiver my parents had signed so I could work there. The receptionist wasn't interested. "Hang on," she said, and disappeared into the back. A not unpleasant-looking man in a white lab coat came out a few minutes later and shook my hand. He seemed too young to be a doctor, but the coat made me hopeful he might actually have a clue. "I'm Dr. Rivard," he said. "And you are?" I told him my name and that I was there to start my summer internship with Dr. Kumar. A cute little wrinkle creased his forehead as he motioned for me to follow him to a bench near the research building's front door. "Rowan," he said, "I'm sorry, but Dr. Kumar had to take a leave of absence a few weeks ago. Her mother's ill and..." I stopped listening then, because no matter what words Dr. Rivard used, the message was going to be blah, 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 you're screwed. Sure, I hadn't wanted to work there in the first place, but I wasn't exactly opposed to racking up volunteer hours and science cred for my college applications. I was just wondering if James's restaurant was hiring when the words "opening at the Jackson Clinic" snapped my attention back to Dr. Rivard's voice. "It may not be what you'd planned," he said, "but they're pretty desperate. And I could check to see if any of the physicians up there will let you shadow them after your shift." He jumped up, grabbed a business card from the receptionist's desk, and scribbled something on the back. "Here's the address. I can call now if you want, and see if they have time to interview you this morning. Wait. Scratch that. Why don't you just head up there and I'll let them know you're on your way." I took the card. The address was somewhere way up in North Tulsa. Dr. Rivard gave me a little grin that, under normal circumstances, I would have considered extremely attractive. "I really think you'd learn a lot there," he said. I smiled and thanked him and told him that sounded great. Because even though working at a medical clinic in the part of town voted most likely to get you shot hadn't been on my summer bucket list, at least it was something. Maybe even something I could get a decent essay out of. Plus, I'd be helping out in exactly the kind of place James goes all gooey over, so he could pretty much suck it on that count. Living in a bubble, my ass. The thing about Tulsa is, it's really three cities in one. The newest is South Tulsa, where the houses are fresh built and come in tall, grande, and venti. People there might work downtown, but at night they escape the urban wilds and head back to comfortable developments named for the wildlife their construction displaced. Quail Commons, Fox Meadows, that kind of thing. Midtown, where I live, is what you get when you squish neighborhoods from every 20th century decade together, starting with the 1910s. In a 7-minute drive, you can go from fancy to comfortable to small to meth house scary. Then there's North Tulsa. Cross the railroad tracks and the northern curve of highways built to shunt commuter traffic away from city streets, and you're there. It's the kind of place where, if people bother talking about it at all, they either say how dangerous it is or describe it in their "it's such a pity" voice. Mom says North Tulsa actually has the lowest crime rate in the city, and she knows her shit. But it is poor, and full of people with skin a few shades darker than pale. And I can't lie. Until I went up to the Jackson Clinic that day, I'd never driven there on my own. I followed the map on my phone north past Greenwood, where businesses rebuilt after the riot but had closed one by one over the years. Beyond that, the streets were wide and quiet. There were no gang fights, no tweakers lurking in doorways, or carjackers waiting on corners. It didn't feel dangerous so much as forgotten. I passed the Dollar General store that had been on the news after a 73-year-old reserve deputy shot Eric Harris in the back nearby. A used tire lot with a hand-lettered Llantas Buenas sign. A trailer surrounded by hundreds of old barbecue grills. A tiny library branch with a sign in front advertising their summer reading program. The clinic was a quarter mile beyond that. It was new, with bright yellow siding and a freshly black-topped parking lot. There was a fence around the perimeter, but only a short one. There were also purple and yellow pansies along the sidewalk, and a girl with a giant rainbow afro painted on the bus stop shelter out front. The inside was nice, with cheap but decent waiting room furniture, a stack of fresh coloring pages on a kid-sized plastic picnic table, and crayons that still had points. An old man with dirty fatigues and a nicotine-stained beard waved at me like a Walmart greeter. "Sign in, darling," he said. "I forgot to when I showed up last week, and they still haven't called my name." His laugh was wheezy and strained and ended in a coughing fit. I started toward him to make sure he was okay, but he waved me on. "I'm fine, young lady," he said between gasps. "You go on." I worked my way through the crowded room toward what was apparently the reception desk. It wasn't behind glass, and there was no annoyed-looking lady waiting to check people in. There was just a man, a really tall one, who looked like he'd taken a long walk through hell and survived. His skin was pocked, his nose was crooked, and a thick, jagged scar ran from his chin down into the neckline of his shirt. Still, his eyes were calm, his face was relaxed, and the anarchy symbol tattooed on the left side of his neck was a nice counterpoint to the praying hands on the right. "Sign in," he pointed to the clipboard on the counter. "I'm not sick," I said. "I'm..." He looked up and smiled a black-toothed meth addict smile. "Family Planning Clinic runs Wednesdays and Fridays. You need an appointment?" My face got hot. "I'm not pregnant." He cut me off with a raised eyebrow. Thus the term family planning. That's when I realized he wasn't serious. He was giving me shit, and I liked him for it. So I grabbed the sign-in sheet and the pen chained to the desk with a string of paper clips and wrote. Name, Rowan Chase. Arrival time, now. Appointment time, don't have one. Care provider, hire me. He took one look and burst out laughing. A woman in pink scrubs called out, "Crystal Montoya," and waved over the anxious-looking woman who stood up. Then the two of them disappeared behind a door. The desk guy was still chuckling when he spoke. "Rowan Chase, I'm Truman Atwell. People usually just call me True. Can you type?" "Pretty well," I said, getting the distinct impression I was being interviewed for a job I wasn't even sure I wanted. "Can you answer phones?" "Yes," I looked around at the waiting room full of people. "Can you get your bright-eyed self here by 7:30 sharp, Monday through Friday, and not complain if I make you stay past 3 from time to time?" "I guess." He took my right hand in both of his and shook it solemnly. "Then, Rowan Chase, I think you and I are going to get along just fine."
William. In a way, everything that came next was my own doing. After all, I was the one who watched that boy stare at the Model 110 in our window every day for a whole week. At first, he only slowed on his delivery bike and craned his neck towards the shop. But come Wednesday, when the street was quiet, he got off that bike and walked right up onto the sidewalk to look in. He was tall, with a sturdy build, a baby face, and the look of someone who'd stopped to put fallen baby birds back in their nests. On Thursday, I happened to be watching passers-by from a corner at the front of the store when he arrived. He must not have noticed me there, for he leaned so close to the shop window that I saw his eyes and recognized the look in them straight away. It was want. Pure, simple want. Come Friday, his forehead bumped the glass. He'd leaned his bicycle against his hip and was so intent on our window display that he didn't notice when I walked outside. "How do you do?" I inquired. He jumped back like I'd lit a match under him. I pointed out how there was a trolley rolling toward